This is the third in a series of three lectures about heuristic evaluation. The first two covered the rationale and the method, and also the first six heuristics. Today we're going to be covering the last four heuristics based on Nielsen's heuristics, and also we'll get into a little bit more of how to conduct the heuristic evaluation, getting into notions of severity, frequency of errors, and so forth. So if you take a peek at the learning objectives of the next slide, we're going to be understanding and describing the last four heuristics, and then we're going to be getting again into the process of heuristic evaluation. Okay, so the seventh, next slide. So the seventh heuristic here is recognition rather than recall. So the basic idea here is that you want to essentially minimize the user's load. You don't want to have to make them remember things. And so the point here is to allow them to see things rather than force them to kind of remember them out of thin air. And essentially what this means is the instructions should be visible whenever it's appropriate. So if you take a peek at the next slide, this is a screenshot from a system called iLike. I don't think the system exists anymore, but at the time it was sort of like a Pandora type of system, internet radio. And one of the things they needed to do was essentially build a profile of the kinds of artists that you liked. And so in principle, you could imagine an interface that actually asked you to type in artists, musicians, and songs that you liked. But instead, the way they do it is that they give you pictures, basically, of different artists, probably their album covers and so forth. And here is an instance where they're asking you to do this using recognition, i.e. you recognize these artists and you recognize their names, rather than trying to have you recall it from scratch. And the point is that actually having people recall things turns out to be a much more difficult task than having them recognize it. It's also much faster to do. If you hit the next slide, this is another example of another sort of recognition rather than recall situation. So autocomplete, essentially, right? So autocomplete for stock ticker symbols, where you can match on all sorts of different stock ticker symbols or even their full names. And you basically, as the person is typing, you basically give them a list. And, you know, if it shows up the exact one that they want, they can just highlight and click. Right. Same dealio when you're writing code, of course. It's far easier to recognize these symbols and function names and so forth than it is to try to come up with them from scratch. If you take a peek at the next slide, this is the font selector thing that you can get in Word 2011 on Word or on OS X. And I'm sure the Windows version also has something similar. But basically, rather than forcing you to remember what the font looks like based on its name, it actually draws the font name using the font itself. So that's essentially recognition rather than recall. Next slide. If you take a peek at the next slide, we're looking at now the eighth heuristic, and this is you're trying to minimize design. And so the way this is articulated is that dialogues should not contain information that is irrelevant or rarely needed, and every extra unit of information in a dialogue competes with relevant bits of information and diminishes the relative visibility. So the way I think about this is when you are designing your interface, try to keep the number of pixels that you are using, like contrasting pixels, at an absolute minimum. Think of it as, you know, ink, essentially. How much ink do you absolutely need? How much ink can you get away with in terms of how little ink, essentially, can you get away with using while still conveying all the functionality of your interface? Can you reduce the number of words? Can you reduce the number of buttons, right? Every additional button that is there causes people to have to make decisions about these buttons. And a decision may be as low level as deciding to ignore it, but the fact that somebody has to make a decision is going to slow their use of that interface. A simple example of this is to think about a menu. Right, so a menu at a restaurant. So if the menu basically has one item, or it's a prefix kind of a menu, you don't have to make any choices. It's very easy to make your way through that menu. On the other hand, if it has 10 items, it takes you a little bit more time. You got to read all 10 items and decide which one you want. If the menu becomes 20 items or 30 or 40, now the amount of time that takes to decide between items becomes much, much more challenging. So if you take a look at the next slide, this is an example of, in some ways this is sort of an overload, kind of overkill kind of example. But if you were building this application, it probably isn't that much of an overload, overkill type of scenario. So this is an application called Super. It's an audio-video converter tool, basically allows you to convert from one video format to another, or one audio format to another. Sometimes it's called a transcoder. And here, this is a situation where the interface actually violates this design principle. So I'm taking a file, and in the very top left, you can see that I said I only want to output as an MP3 file. That is, I only want to output an audio file. And nevertheless, in spite of this, essentially, all the video stuff is still there. That green area is still there. It may actually be grayed out, but the fact that I have to look at it is a real pain in the butt, right? It is diverting my attention away from the thing that I actually need to click through, which is the blue area that is referring to the audio stuff, right? So that is that the fact that it's not blurred out or gone altogether means that it takes some of my attention. It takes me more time to make my way through this interface. In contrast, if it wasn't there at all, it'd be super easy to make my way through this interface. If you take a look at the next slide, this is something that we see more and more on the internet, on sort of Web 2.0 sites, essentially the notion of hover controls. So here you have a situation, so this is Twitter. Here you have a situation where basically these widgets, that little star and that reply arrow that are on the right side, they only appear when they are likely to be used, i.e. when the mouse is hovering over the activation area. The downside of this approach is essentially that it's difficult to discover just by inspecting or just by looking at the interface. You are likely to discover it if you can move your mouse around, but if you don't have a mouse, say if you're using a touch interface, then these kind of hover widgets don't really work. If you take a look at the next slide, this is something that Gmail offers, the ability to kind of add a file. And if you want to add more than one file, you hit attach another file. And then kind of basically that choose file and the file name and the remove thing appear. So you can click that many times if you want more. So again, the great thing about this is that it only shows up when you ask for it. But on the other hand, it makes it a little bit more difficult to discover. Next slide. So that's basically aesthetic and minimalist design. You want your system and the interface to essentially have as few widgets as possible to while still retaining all the functionality. So if there are opportunities to get rid of stuff, then you want to make sure that you actually do so. Next slide. Flexibility and efficiency of use. So this one refers essentially to the ability to have accelerator keys and shortcuts sort of expert users can make use of, people that are really familiar with your system, rather than make them necessarily go through the interface in a sort of cumbersome click-by-click way. The other thing that you want to do here is allow the user to sort of create macros or tailor frequent actions that they may use. So an accelerator key is essentially, keyboard shortcuts is one way to think about it. To kind of get stuff done. One example that actually violates this accelerator key and flexibility guideline is the UCIT login page. And in fact, it's not this page anymore. I think they updated it, but I can't remember whether they've actually fixed this problem yet. So it turns out that actually when you hit tab, it actually moves between the controls. And depending on how the controls are laid out on the display or on the screen, it will basically follow a certain pattern. So for me, typically if I'm typing in my username, I'll type in my username, press tab, make it to the password field, press tab again, and I should be able to sign in right away. In this old design, and I'm not sure if it's the same in the new design, when you press tab from the password field, it would bring you to this, it would highlight the disclaimer field, which is completely inane because that should be the fourth thing or not one of the controls that is highlighted at all. Actually, I'm just reading some of my notes. In some browsers on Safari, moving from the password field, you press tab, it actually brings you right to the address field of your browser for who knows what reason. Okay, next slide. So here are some common accelerator keys that you can use for Chrome browser on OS X. So, you know, like the Open Apple T brings up a new tab, so on and so forth. So the notes are here, right? Basically, when you use an accelerator, you feel and look like a boss. You really kind of make it through an interface really quickly. The interface basically just flows. It just kind of works for you, right? And, you know, the problem is when you take these things away, it makes it more annoying to use an interface. The trick with this is that you want to be building in these accelerators in such a way that they kind of map with, they're consistent on the platform. If you kind of change up these accelerator keys from application to application or platform to platform, it's going to cause a little bit of frustration. The current representation, the way they kind of communicate these accelerator keys to you on the Mac platform, is that they actually show them to you on the right side as this is a set of symbols. I believe that the Windows interface does this slightly differently. That is that the accelerator keys are hidden until you press, I believe it's the Windows key, and when you press and hold the Windows key, now this is a toggle mode, it actually underlines the letters that actually result in an accelerator key. So in some ways, the current representation on OS X is very cluttered, obviously. A lot of people is using a lot of ink that we don't need. A lot of people don't care about. It makes it more discoverable, you would argue, though, in contrast to the Windows version of this. All right, so next slide. Now we're going to be talking about sort of help and documentation. So even if it's better if the system can be used without documentation, it may be necessary to provide help and documentation throughout. So you'd want this information to be easy to search, focusing on the user's task and listing concrete steps to be carried out and making sure that those steps themselves are not too large. If you hit the next slide, here's an example that you can kind of provide some help. One of the things that you can do is actually you can have the width of the field indicate sort of or hint at the amount of text that is supposed to be written in there. Other things that you can do are have this sort of like hint text that shows you sort of like what is supposed to actually be in a particular area. And there you can see in the revised version, there's a little help button that somebody can click, and presumably it kind of gives you a tooltip or something like that that basically is contextual help that says, hey, this is what's supposed to be in here. So if you hit the next slide, a whole bunch of different things sort of constitute help. So beyond sort of tutorials and get start manuals, there's also reference manuals, reminders, wizards, and tips. So that covers sort of the 10 heuristics that come out of Nielsen's usability heuristics. What I want to do next is cover how you actually go about doing a heuristic evaluation. And it essentially has four different steps. So hopefully you're looking at the slide that says conducting heuristic evaluation. So I told you in the past that you need about 3 to 5 evaluators. Hopefully they're trained. If they're not, what you actually do is you provide them with people that have domain knowledge about the application area, with information about the security, the scenario, and also sort of these heuristics and how they're actually used. Then you actually do the evaluation where the individuals actually conduct the evaluation themselves as individuals. And then after that, once the evaluations are complete, then you aggregate these results and look at them together. You also assign severity ratings. And again, what you do is you do this individually, and then you do it as a group through discussion. Then you debrief and discuss the outcome of the heuristic evaluation with your entire design team or your engineering team. So this is what an evaluation actually looks like. Oh, it's the next slide. So each evaluator performs at least 2 passes. In the first one, you're just trying to understand what the system is like. In the second one, you're actually focusing on specific elements, so perhaps specific screens and that sort of thing. Typically, if you want to provide people with a set of scenarios, so these scenarios can actually come from your task-centered system design, for instance. In this case, if you were recruiting people to do your heuristic evaluation, and they didn't have any experience with your interface before, you would actually want to give them the steps to actually complete the task using your interface. So not only giving them the abstract task description, but also the steps that they need to use to complete the task. The exception to this is if it's sort of a walk-up and use scenario. Okay, so here, walk-up and use scenario means sort of like a system that you would build for a shopping mall directory or something like that. All right. Then what you do as an evaluator is you basically walk through the scenarios and produce a set of, and you look at the interface, you have your heuristics next to you, and you basically produce a list of problems. Explain why with respect to the heuristics or other information why something is a problem, and you want to be specific and list each problem separately. So each line basically becomes its own problem. Okay. If you hit the next slide, an example of this that we talked about a little bit, I was talking about the UCID login page, is tabbing from the password field lands in the disclaimer link rather than submit. So you would actually articulate this as a problem. And then in sort of the next column, what you would say is that this violates the consistency heuristic as well as the accelerator's heuristics. So then you would also articulate a fix, and you want to sort of essentially reorder the tab stops. Okay, so that's an example. So why you would actually list each, next slide, why you would actually list each violation, because remember that you're going to aggregate this again later, and actually if they're each individually separated by line, it makes it easier to sort of bring them together. So different places where the problems may be found. Sometimes they're going to be found in a single location in the UI. Sometimes they're going to be two or more locations that need to be compared. Another way, an example of that would be the consistency heuristic, right? So remember the stock quote versus stock ticker, you know, all these different, or ticker symbol or whatever. So different places. So you'd need to actually be able to reference back to where the problem is, actually. It may be the overall structure of the UI. So basically the task flow doesn't make sense given the user interface, or something is missing. It's a little bit hard to see if something is missing with paper prototypes, which is why often heuristic evaluations are done later on with software prototypes, but it's not always the case. Okay, so once you've conducted this evaluation on your own, you aggregate them together with all the problems that your group has come up with together. And of course, you get rid of duplicates and that sort of stuff. But what you will probably find is that you have found different problems than your teammates. So if you hit the next slide, the next thing you need to do is essentially assign severity ratings. And this is essentially to sort of prioritize between these different problems and figure out which ones you actually really need to do. And the severity rating often can be done in a scale of 0 to 4. And 0 to 4 is sort of a combination of how frequently is somebody going to run into this problem if they're using the tool? What is the impact, right? What is the persistence? Is it a one-time thing or is it a repeating thing? So you want to estimate these things for each of the problems that you've seen. And it's best if you can do this independently and then again come together as a group so that you can actually compare notes. The reason why you do this independently is because it's very easy otherwise to be swayed by a particularly loud member of the group. And this is something that can happen in even professional teams. So if you take a next, if you hit the next slide, you can actually see kind of my version of severity ratings, 0 to 4. 0, I don't think this is a usability problem. 4 is this is a usability catastrophe. You must fix, otherwise people can't use the system properly. And then there's stuff in between, right? It's a cosmetic problem or it's a major usability problem, and it's important to fix. So you essentially kind of do this based on your best judgment. So an example, if we come back to the severity stuff, you can actually ask the question about whether or not the disclaimer rather than submit tab thing is actually really a huge problem. I would say that on the most, like my gut reaction to this, actually, why don't you take a moment and figure out what you think about this. Okay, I hope you took that moment and took a guess. My own take on this is that probably this ranks kind of somewhere in the 1 to 2 range. It's a problem, but very few people are going to run into this problem. Basically, Tony Tang is going to run into this problem and a few of his students because he told them about it, right? Other than that, That's basically it. Those are the only people that are going to run into it. Maybe kind of your hardcore keyboard users are going to run into it. But this is actually something that's important to think about, right? Think about what should the severity of this problem be. Okay, next slide. So once you've done that, then you can actually go back and debrief. So you conduct this with evaluators, observers, development team members, and you basically talk about general issues in the UI, and you want to talk about big problems and potential improvements. And then typically what the dev team will do is they'll say, well, this is all too expensive to fix. And so this is where you make your case for the most important ones. And what can work well is you make it a brainstorming session where everybody sort of works together and you kind of hint at what the solutions are. All right, so that wraps up essentially heuristic evaluation. I've told you that it is a discount usability technique that you can use to evaluate an interface without real users. It is not the same as having an evaluation with real users, but you can find many usability bugs without actually having to recruit users, which can be time intensive and expensive. Thank you very much.